You're listening to Shift in Action, a program of wisdom media and spirited exchange offered through the Institute of Noetic Sciences. For more information, visit www.shiftinaction.com.
That's all the amps he's got. Well, I always want to meet the audience first. Make sure they're genuine and that they're the real thing. This is the real thing. And it's my joy to be here. This is a very sophisticated audience, by the way. Noetic science. I mean, only the most sophisticated people in the world even hear of this. 99.9% of the people of the world never even heard of noetic science or what is talked about here. And so, we're a very fortunate group of people, you know. Itself as all of us here at this moment. Certain pieces of information jump one's consciousness enormously merely to have heard it. To understand it takes another 450 lifetimes, but this morning, the hidden gift is you don't have to think about anything. There's no thinking necessary today, nor do you even have to understand it. So we start out in the winner's circle. We'll start out with the conclusion and lead back to the beginning, and that will make it all very clear. This audience calibrates at 4:42. Yeah. We usually calibrate the audience before and after the lecture. Yeah. And we also stop and calibrate the truth of anything that's in question, or that I intuit is in question or doubtful because it's so... bizarre. The actual truth in this world is quite bizarre. And people are not used to it, and therefore there's truth shock. So we stop and recalibrate whether or not what we just said is true. And we'll do that with the very first, from the very first. The major block to a group such as this is the 400s, is the intellect. The very foundation and basis of the intellect is the firm conviction and belief in the principle of causality. Because of the principle of causality, most people in the 400s are stuck there. Very few people escape the 400s. 5% of the world's population ever transcends the intellect, which calibrates in the 400s. 5% ever escapes. Even Einstein couldn't escape. He landed at 499 and couldn't get beyond that paradigm jump. So to help, then, to make this paradigm jump, we'll try to demonstrate and explain what makes it simple. What makes it simple? And don't try to understand anything I'm saying, because it's not understandable. We're not going to deal within the world of the intellect. so you can relax. The first great barrier to enlightenment, then, in a group such as this, which has read everything, been everywhere, and heard everyone, is... is the principle of causality. The explanation that things all have a cause. There is a this that is causing a that. So long as you believe there is a this causing a that, we have perpetrator and victim. You have ego and spirit. You have self with a small s and self with a large s, and you're stuck. So long as you believe there is something causing anything out there. If there's no cause as an explanation for anything, then how does things come about? We'll give an example of the facile shallowness and inappropriateness of causality as an explanation. The child says to the teacher, why does the flower follow the sun? And the teacher says, heliotropism. The kid says, wow, Mom, heliotropism. Doesn't know anything more than it knew before. But it has an explanation. So the thing about the intellect is it tries to find explanations. It creates mentalizations and then projects them into the world and presumes that the mentalization is a reality. That thereby setting up a dualistic thought system which anchors the ego where it is. If things don't come about via causality, then how to explain the phenomenal world that we witness? We'll explain it thusly. Let's take the principle of causality and calibrate it and see where is it. The principle of causality calibrates over 440, 450, 460. The principle of causality calibrates about 460. So what's the usual explanation for creation? What's his name? Darwin. Oh, yeah. So Darwin's theory of evolution is over... No, not evolution. What does he call it? Yeah, evolution he calls it. Yeah, okay. I forgot. Over 450, 455, 460, 465, 470. Okay. So the explanation for the phenomenal world is... The explanation calibrates at 460. 460, when you're 420, sounds erudite, but when you're at 550, it sounds dumb. All comes into existence by virtue of the presence of God. Because there is no other possibility. Nothing has the power within it to create its own existence. Any theory of causality, going back through billiard balls, A, B, C, D, back into time, eventually comes to the source and the origination. The belief of the mind is that there is a this causing a that in a sequential series. Scientific investigation, then, has been devoted considerably to finding the this that causes the that, with great benefit to society. So the benefits of the intellect and science are enormous. So we're not putting down the intellect, we're just saying to become enlightened is one of the problems you have to surmount, just like the problem of abundance. You will start these programs, how to get abundance. And then they come to a postgraduate program where we teach classes on what to do with the problem of abundance. You got too many of everything, you're drowning it. So, if things are not happening as a result of causation, then how does it happen? Everything has its own, you might say, karmic, intrinsic morphically designed potentiality. Everything within creation comes forth as a potentiality. That potentiality, because of the presence of God, then becomes an actuality. So witness the rose. You see, the rose is half open, and you see the rose opening progressively. First of all, it does not go from imperfection to perfection. It goes from perfection to perfection. All of creation at every instant is absolutely perfect. It is perfectly and completely 100% its potentiality at this moment. Then it becomes its potentiality at this moment, perfectly that potentiality. Then it is perfectly its potentiality at this moment. Then it's perfectly. So the rose goes from perfection to perfection, from completion to completion. There is no incompletion in the universe. Everything is complete and total, actualizing its potential at any one given moment of time. Nothing is causing the rose to do anything. Going from potentiality to actuality is dependent on local conditions. So with sunshine and water, this actuality, this potentiality, tends to actualize. Without them, it does not tend to actualize, which is the way it's supposed to be. Without sun and water, the rose is supposed to turn brown and fall over. And then everybody feels sad. We have a funeral service. Poor dead rose. In the world of causality, all is perpetrator or victim. So we find, who is the perpetrator that killed the rose? They should be properly punished and identified. You know? There is a this causing a that. So we have a world of endless conflict and contention, in which the perpetrator, cause and victim, is so endemic in our society, frankly, no citizen is safe, because every one of you at this very moment can be cited as a perpetrator from some particular contextualization, you see? All right, so, therefore, everything goes from potentiality into actuality, and it does so by virtue of the power, the infinite power of the presence of God, divinity. The ego is the content of the field, and divinity is the name we've traditionally given to the infinite spiritual power out of which arises the entire universe. What seems to be sequential is not happening in a sequential way at all. What's happening is, let's say, Darwin's theory of evolution, see? You'll see very simply that creation and evolution are one and the same thing. The simple fact that makes it clear is that creation is continuous. Creation is continuous because the presence of God is continuous. It's hardly possible for God to have appeared briefly back in history in Genesis and disappears until some future date where you meet him in Judgment Day. Oh, whoa. In the meantime, what is he doing? I mean, I don't know. On Social Security or what? I don't know. The presence of God, if you understand, I mean, to really even intellectually get the possibility of what it means, divinity, must exist always or doesn't exist at all. No possibility for a brief appearance of divinity. Divinity is therefore ongoing and continuous at all times. And how does divinity function? Divinity doesn't function. That solves that one. Divinity doesn't do anything. That's a big relief. The presence of God is an infinite power. Without parts, positions, movements, without anthropomorphic projections, without feelings, devoid of chakras, psychological problems, and an unconscious mind. Not in need of psychoanalysis or therapy. not capricious, not angry, not emotionally disturbed, not paranoid, not vengeful. An infinite field, then, of infinite power, must of necessity have no divisions or parts, and is more like gravity. To understand, then, karma and many spiritual concepts, it's more useful to know that the nonlinear domain of infinite power, called God throughout time, called divinity, is more like an infinite electromagnetic field of infinite dimension and infinite power, within which, like little iron filings, everything that has existence, karmically, let's say, has a design, has a polarity, has a charge. As you can see, in a field of infinite power, every little particle, which is us people, is automatically lines up in the field according to its own charge, its own polarity, its own karmic destiny. Everything is within the domain of divinity. Everything is aligned within the field according to its own karmic inheritance. Therefore, the justice of God is instant and absolute and eternal, and judgment day is today. Judgment day is every moment, because no iron filing can be anywhere else than it is, because the field is infinitely powerful, and everyone is exactly where it can be and cannot be any other place. Which explains what happens at death. Then the spirit merely leaves the body, and the spirit is exactly where it is aligned in this infinite field. If you like church music, you drift to church music. Anybody's been out of body? How many people here have been out of body? Zounds. Okay, how many near-death experiences? All right, so you know the instant you leave the body, which brings up the fact that we might as well handle some of the nice things to start with. If one thing is obvious, you cannot experience your own death. It's not possible to experience your own physical death, because at the instant of physical death, you're already out of it. And you look at the body laying there, and he looks pretty poor, too, doesn't he? The instant of physical death, spirit instantly leaves the body, and the bullet that's going to kill you, you don't feel. The bullet that you feel is okay. When you feel something ripping through your gut, you're safe. When you see it splattering out the back and you don't feel anything, you know you've left. Everybody else is going, whoa, and you're up here. Everybody at the moment they're born already has a calibratable level of consciousness. Every single entity at the moment of birth, at the moment of conception, actually, and the spirit enters the body in the third month of gestation, already has a calibratable level of consciousness. The exact moment of death is already set also. The exact timing. Don't ask me to explain that. The exact timing, the exact moment is also already decided. So we're born with a calibratable level of consciousness. How did such a wide range of consciousness manifest itself in the newborn unless there was previous lives? You know, maybe you can explain it some other way. Accidentalism, huh? Well, people say genes and chromosomes. Well, see, those are the means. If you have very bad karma, then you have very bum chromosomes and genes, and you're born with all kinds of terrible diseases and afflictions, and you die at age 6. Because that was the energy you're born with. So karmically, then, we enter this domain, parent domain, with a calibratable level of consciousness, and the exact moment of death is already set. The means of death, the style of death, and what leads up to it is not set. That's, you have freedom about it. you can stagger there or run there, you know what I mean? Do it with an oxygen tank or a motorcycle, it's all yours. But the exact moment is it. And of course, I can cite many examples of it. You know, a famous one 15 years ago where at 36,000 feet, the door to this airplane opens. Exactly one person is pulled out the door out of 350 passengers. Just one. It's like God said, your time. She, I think, was the stewardess, but 350 people, exactly one. So, all right, so we're born then. We'll have to go how consciousness arises over long periods of time, and then we're going to do the map of consciousness and go through some slides to put this all together. On this planet, then, if you go back, way, way, way back, I mean very far back, there was no really visible life, discernible life. And life as it began on this planet then had quite a struggle. You can imagine trying to colonize Mars. You can see life, its first obstacle would be survival. Therefore, life as it appeared on this planet and evolved over millions of years began in the most simple, rudimentary form. And obviously, it had to be programmed and oriented and dedicated, those are projections from my mind on it, this little germ or whatever it was. Its first project was survival. And it had to be designed for survival, and its intentionality as it evolved over time had to be primarily survival. If your plane crashes in Antarctica, your problem is going to be survival. So, life on this planet, then, out of consciousness arose the energy of life, which evolved from the lowest forms, and its problem was survival. Not even multiplication yet, but multiplication came along as a form of survival. So, life then evolved with numerous challenges to gain a foothold. There you see the beginning of the ego. Because as life evolves over periods of time, you see the very lowest life forms. Eventually you see, let's say when we get to a higher life form, reptiles and dinosaurs and various things. Well, if you calibrate the energy of Tyrannosaurus Rex, you'll find it's about 70. It's about the same as the Komodo dragon. Komodo dragon is a living example of that whole era. Komodo dragon calibrates around 70. Its only intention is me. And in order for me to survive, it's necessary to kill you. And the Komodo dragon has perfected it. One bite, and it doesn't have to kill you, it just gives you a bite and goes away. And it settles down and waits. And eventually you die and then it has dinner. As you can see, its intention is not spiritually corrupt. It doesn't intend to kill you. It just intends to have dinner. The tiger doesn't kill the rabbit. He just has lunch. That's lunch, four-footed lunch. Warm, and his lunch is warm. So the tiger likes warm lunch and has a propensity for rabbits. Yeah. All right, then life evolves, in other words, from a self-centeredness. It's not spiritually corrupt because it's just being what it is. Life evolves then from self-centeredness and survival. It then evolves to higher forms. We see the bird, the mother bird. For the first time you see caring about another. The reptile doesn't care about another, it lays its eggs and wanders away. But in the bird, you see, the mother bird shows concern about the egg and the little peoplings. And then when you see the evolution of mammalian life, you see the first appearance of real concern of others and the first appearance of love. So love, you might say, arises, presents itself through the maternal, through the feminine, which begins to express concern, caringness, etc. Then you see the hominids appear, Cro-Magnon man, you see. Neanderthal man calibrates around 70-75. Cro-Magnon man, Piltdown man, Neanderthal man, all those people. Never met any, except in New York City. They live in a certain area of New York City. Anyway. Cro-Magnon man, and then you see Homo erectus. You can calibrate the levels of all of these hominids coming off the evolutionary branch. And you see that one genus does not dissolve into another. Instead, a new branch constantly arises. So the core of survival then in the animal, which is still present within the human brain, is me and my survival. Consequently, there's no point in feeling guilt about the ego, because the ego is merely the survival of the animal evolution. If you take the ego apart and give it different names, you'll see it's just an animal. It's interested in me, it's interested in my survival, it's interested in fighting for territory. And the wolf, you see the beginning of the pack, you see the bonding of male to male. Romantic love doesn't even appear until extremely late in very recent times, only really a few hundred years ago. Men and women didn't hang out together. Women talked about babies and stuff like that, and guys went out and did war and got drunk and whoring and drinking and brawling and killing people was what guys were about. And women didn't find that too interesting, so they hung out with themselves and the guys hang out with themselves. And romance didn't play any part of this. There was a lot of eroticism, but not romance. And people got married by arrangement by their families. The dynasties of Europe were all arranged for political and financial gain. And it's only very recent then, very recent, that romantic love has appeared as a desirable virtue. Love is extremely recent. Caring about the welfare of others, then, is just recently birthed on the planet. Recently birthed. Doesn't even appear until you see the mammalian series, the mammalians, and then you see the hominids. So, to care about others, much less to care about the environment or the quality of life, is extremely recent. In fact, it just got born in evolutionary time. Just got born, practically. For those doing spiritual work, and especially those interested in transcending the ego, today we want to give the outlines of the intrinsic structure of the ego. To approach the ego, then, it's first necessary to hold it in a certain contextual manner so as not to go into guilt, self-flagellation, and suicide. I had a Freudian psychoanalysis, so I didn't contemplate suicide too seriously for too long. Anyway, when you begin to look into the unconscious, you want to go a little bit shocked, because what do you discover there? You're going to discover the reptile, the animal, the me, self-centeredness. So the ego then is what's left of the animal within us, still present physically. Now, in Homo sapien, we now have a frontal cortex, a few more millimeters of gray matter in the frontal cortex, which makes all the difference in the world. So what happens to the human, to the animal nature then, when you develop a frontal cortex? All the foregoing becomes more and more sophisticated. That's all that happens. We don't need to attack with teeth. We attack with words, concepts, strife, etc. Tribal warfare goes on the same as usual. And frankly, the front page of any day's newspaper is the same as today's events on Monkey Island in any zoo. This tribe is attacking this tribe. This tribe is making this tribe good. This is trying to get dominance over this one. The males are surreptitiously trying to grab all the females in the background. Everybody's trying to pile up their own big pile of manure or whatever they got. Everybody's righteous, denouncing everybody else. The way to get away from denunciation is very simple. Because you like vanilla, you don't have to hate chocolate. There you got it. Because you love chocolate, you don't have to hate vanilla. You don't have to kill vanilla. You don't have to vilify it. You don't have to demonize it. Well, that's the way a lot of people make their living, so I hate to undermine that, but hatred is a well-paying trade right now. All right, so let's go to the calibrated levels of consciousness, because we want to review now what we said from a different viewpoint. The events of this particular lifetime were peculiar and unique. I was always a misfit. I discovered that recently. Yeah. I was always a misfit. Thank you. I suspected I was a misfit. I used to tell my analyst I was a misfit. He said it was just a neurotic distortion, but it was a fact. Due to previous lifetimes, as a Hinayana Buddhist, I had always gone out of body into the void. In fact, one of my former colleagues from those days is sitting up here, and we'll get him to do the chant for us later. What's the name of what you're going to chant?
The Lotus Sutra.
Oh, the Lotus Sutra, yeah, in Sanskrit. So we'll have that for dessert. Having gone out of body each time into the void, you see, because that which you believe tends to manifest. So that error in Buddhism, which I recognize in this lifetime, that, you see, all right, we'll just do it chronologically. At age three, out of nothingness, out of void, absolute nothingness, suddenly there was a profound and stunning consciousness of existence. Wordless, three-year-olds don't have vocabularies. Suddenly at age three, there was a stunning presentation, confrontation with existence. It was like a shocking, stunning brilliance. Existence as such, that which I am is existence, is the way I can word it now. At that time at age three, it was the knowingness of self as existence. Instantly, shortly thereafter, came up the fear of non-existence. That which exists then brings with it the possibility it could have come about that whatever was experiencing existence would not have come into existence. And so the confrontation at the ridiculous age of three was the conundrum, the paradox, which you can't solve till you get to consciousness level 850, of the infinite reality of God as existence versus non-existence, whether reality is nothingness or allness. That only took 50 years to figure out. So this was a strange life to begin with. And children didn't seem very interesting. They were extremely boring, frankly. And so I escaped into Plato and the great books of the Western world. And while they were playing stickball, I was reading Aristotle and various strange things. So it was an abnormal kind of a lifetime. And at the same time, quite driven. And I just want to highlight the peculiar things from which it explains sort of the level of consciousness from which I speak. Then in teenage, I had a paper route in Wisconsin, 18 miles in the blizzard, 10 below zero, and there was no electricity along the highway. Everything was pitch black, 10 below zero, blizzard, and the bicycle fell over and the newspapers flew away. And there was a huge snowbank with crusted snowbank. So I punched my way into the snowbank and burrowed my way in and to get out of the wind. And no sooner did I do that than an infinite presence beyond description, like the most soft, like the essence of love, melted away any sense of a personal self. There was no person there, no Dave there, no thinking there, no thought there, no mind there. Only the infinite presence, whose duration was infinite, was always, went on for eons, outside of time. And the awareness that the reality that was experiencing it was beyond time. That which I am existed before all universes, and that which I am will exist after all universes have disappeared. was the awareness at age 12 or 14. And that awareness was a fact. It's over 900, 950, 960, 970, 970. And awareness to Calvary is at 970. And then after that, the difficulty was returning to the world, and my father found me there. But our 29 Model A Ford tracked me down, and he's shaking my knee. And I realized he believes in death. And I state the idea that death is comical. But he believed in death. And if I didn't, like, rebreathe this body and make it go again, he would think I died and grieve me. So out of love for my father, I re-identified with the body. Bad mistake, but anyway. That which is beyond beginnings and endings. That which is beyond beginnings and endings is the essence of that which you are. Divinity within yourself as the self with a capital S. You know? The near-death experience, what the world would call a near-death experience. In an out-of-body experience, the calibrated level of consciousness doesn't change. But after a near-death experience, it shows a very major leap. And there are many famous doctors who have written books who would survive a heart attack, and they would have shared with us the shift of consciousness and profound change that came about in their own personality. One effect is the complete loss of fear of death, and which was handy in World War II on a minesweeper with mines blowing up around you and the ship about to blow up at any second. It was handy not to be afraid of death. Save you throwing up and laying on the deck like most everybody else in the crew. But in the shock, sudden loud noises, if a gun goes off behind your head, it has no disturbance. It's like one's identity is now with the field and not with the content of the field. You realize that you are the field, you're not the content of the field. So everybody's reality here is the field. We are the field. Huh? And in trying to benefit the world then, as we advance our own consciousness, we benefit the field. And we'll get to the quantum mechanics of that later. Let's look at the calibrated level of the consciousness. So this was always a misfit, a peculiar entity on the planet here. And that the level of the consciousness kept doing that throughout lifetime. And would suddenly without warning advance, and one would be stunned out of capacity to function, which is why I left the East. I had the largest psychiatric practice in the United States at the time. And I just walked away from it because in this profound inner silence, there's nothing you can say to anybody. And so I took all my tools out of the tool room, got in my old truck, and drove away. Everybody thinking you've lost your mind. So if your friends all think you've lost your mind, you're probably in a good space. He doesn't want to eat. He doesn't care about it. You know, you can live in one apple. You have a cot and an apple, and what more do you need? I don't know. There's nothing more you need. All right. So the map of consciousness then came about because I was witnessing a class in kinesiology, and the explanation that was given for the kinesiologic response was one of local causality. Due to my own inner experiences, I've gone way beyond local causality as an explanation for phenomena. And I saw merely it was the response of consciousness. It was the response of consciousness itself which expressed itself through the kinesiologic response. It's not a local phenomena. You know, holding figs on your solar plexus makes you go weak. It's supposed to indicate you're allergic to figs. It doesn't work that way. All right, so we'll just say a word about kinesiology. You make a statement. The response of consciousness. Consciousness recognizes truth. In fact, that's the only thing consciousness can recognize. It does not recognize falsehood. So the kinesiologic response is not yes or no. It's yes or not yes. And we'll see why when we do a condensation of quantum mechanics, that you can collapse the wave function and do yes and change the universe. But you can't say no. The universe, so in the recognition of truth then, you, due to the effect of consciousness, the body goes strong. The peculiar thing about consciousness, is that it's beyond form, and yet it registers all form. Consciousness, when we get to the scale of consciousness, we'll see where it is. Consciousness itself is an infinite field of infinite duration of alwaysness that registers everything that ever has had existence. Every thought, feeling, word, deed, everything that's ever happened in the history of mankind is registered forever and retrievable right this instant. Because consciousness is beyond time, space, duration. Therefore, whatever is there is retrievable instantly now. Every detail of Napoleon's life, every detail of Caesar, and the book we're working on now, like 6,000 calibrations, we've gone back and calibrated many of the major events in human history, many major people, writings, places, everything from Central Park to the pyramids of Egypt. And we just came back from Europe where we toured a lot of the cathedrals, etc. So everything that's ever existed, we can ask a question about. Now, how do we find out the fact is we make a statement. This morning, I was thinking about this life as a peculiarity. And so I said, what I'm holding in mind, all right, I'm not going to tell you what it's about. Okay. What I'm holding in mind now is over 840, 850, 860, 870. Thank you. I don't have to tell her what I'm thinking. So I can hold an image in mind. I could hold the Bhagavad Gita. I could hold anything or anyone in time. And then I say, what I'm holding in mind calibrates over so-and-so until I get to the number. So I hold in mind and I make a statement. The other person need not know what I'm holding in mind at all. She didn't know whether I was holding a donkey or Jesus Christ in mind. You see what I'm saying? She had no way of knowing. Consequently, it's the first means of discerning truth from falsehood ever discovered in the evolution of mankind. Mankind has suffered endless disaster, pain, agony, and suffering. Massive starvation, massive slaughterings. In my lifetime, 100 million people have been slaughtered at the hands of megalomaniacs and a naive populace that doesn't know a megalomaniac from a leader. Follows the megalomaniac right over the side of the cliff by the tens of millions, mankind surrenders and slaughters his life and that of his fellow man, wives and children. If you don't care about yourself, what about your family? Is what I say to people, you know. What about your family? How about them? Jesus Christ and the Buddha and Krishna all said one and the same thing. Every enlightened being says, there's only one sin, in quotes, and that is ignorance. There's only one explanation. Why? Because the consciousness of mankind is like the hardware of a computer. No discernment. And it will play any software you put in it. The hardware has no capacity to tell whether the software is playing is true or false. It just plays anything that's programmed into it. So consciousness is like the innocence of the hardware. That's why a course like the Course in Miracles says that intrinsically all men are innocent. And to forgive them, you must see that intrinsically they are innocent. Even as they're killing you with a machine gun, you see they're doing that out of innocence. They are doing it for their fear, they're doing it for God, they're doing it for the country, they're doing it for their family, they're doing it for the flag, they're doing it for their religion. Whatever they think they're doing it for, it's out of innocence that they do it, because they are at the effect of the program. They have no capacity to tell truth from falsehood. The human mind is not capable of telling truth from falsehood. The great minds that have ever lived. I have the great books of the Western world at home, an impressive series of tomes. That was my reading stuff as a kid. Yeah, God. Calibrates about 460. The greatest minds, the ones which we great, the statues and great awe, calibrated 460, which is, yeah, right. Supreme Court's heart in that. So,